Hello there, and welcome back to Innovators in Care. I'm your host, Reuben Bush, and this is the show where we sit down with thought leaders in health and social care to talk about the problems they're solving and how they are using innovation to reduce system-wide pressures and improve patient outcomes. In our first episode, we sat down with Amy Hassan to talk about UCR and keeping people in their own homes. Now today, we move on to the ambulance service. We're sitting down with Andy Collin, consultant paramedic for urgent care at South East Coast Ambulance Service. Andy has been in the NHS for over 30 years and brings his considerable experience to bear on meeting the many challenges in urgent care and the ambulance service. In this episode, we dive into the current pressures on the ambulance service and discuss where we should be going with risk appetite and responding to falls. Enjoy. Hello, Andy. Welcome to Innovators in Care.
Hi, Reuben. How are you?
Yes, good. And you?
Yeah.
Very good. I think it'd be good to start, Andy, with if you just tell us a bit about yourself, your backstory, and what you've done in your career so far, and then what you're doing now.
Yeah, wow. So quite a long time in the NHS, 30 plus years. I won't get into the precise number because it feels so long. Currently, I'm a consultant paramedic covering urgent care for South East Coast Ambulance Service. So leading up to that, I've done pretty much every role in the ambulance sector, working my way up through the organisation clinically. Done some other exciting things in my career. I was involved in the paramedic prescribing project nationally to get paramedics to a legal position where they can independently prescribe or train to be independent prescribers. I spent 2 years with the Healthcare Safety Investigation Branch as a national investigator looking at healthcare safety, funnily enough. They're looking at national safety risks and producing reports with them. That was a really exciting time, really opened my eyes to how things can go wrong and how we need to look into things differently and learn. I've done some writing, got involved in research, some articles, been involved in some books. Done a lot, but fundamentally, I'm still a paramedic. Love seeing patients. I do a day a week in primary care now, as well as my trust role, still go out on ambulances. So that's me really, how I've got to where I've got to.
Very good. There's a lot in the news at the moment, isn't there, about the ambulance service and how busy they are. Why is that?
It's clearly a range of factors. So there are some sort of novel problems or emerging problems that are really starting to bite. So flow through hospital, so access to social care. So it's not a front door problem. It's quite well documented that it's sort of a sort of back door of the hospital problem, you know, flowing patients out and getting them back into society. That creates problems for us at the front door because we have ambulances queuing. So that takes resource out of our operational picture. Call rates have grown and they have steadily grown. And then there's care becoming more complex. So when our staff are on scene, particularly in the older patient cohort, and it's true actually of younger patients as well, but more commonly older patients, that they are living with more complexity that needs to be considered. They may have other wishes. They may be at end of life. So we're managing a sort of palliative care episode or supporting a palliative care episode. They may have had no contact with services. So where do we go from there? We need to speak to GPs. We need to speak to other parts of the system. So that all takes time. So our on-scene times are growing. So that combination of call rates fundamentally probably is it's not a problem, it's a nice problem to have. I look back at my career and the perception of us as ambulance drivers, although the BBC have been using that term a lot recently, which is just make us chuckle. We can call each other ambulance drivers, but no one can call us ambulance drivers. But joking aside, that was a perception that perhaps the public had, that you know, you called an ambulance and some people would turn up and they would, you know, stretch you away to hospital. As our profession has evolved, we're a mobile healthcare provider. We're providing more care. That care has become more complex. it's probably, again, that cyclical nice problem to have. You know, the influence of people like Josh from Casualty, you know, the sort of the archetypal paramedic that can fix everything. Well, we can't fix everything, but we've become really trusted. So some patients do choose the 999 service as their primary route into unscheduled care. Patients that have care line pendants, the care line providers often have no other recourse than to call 999, because if the patient says they're fallen, well, you know, we're back to, you know, how do we manage any fall? So, you know, again, it's that those call rates increasing for probably those three main reasons. So, you know, system-based pressure, increased call rates, and then the time it takes for each call to get done because of that, those additional pressures on scene, that complexity needing to reach out to other parts of the system, you know, all has a burden. Yeah, it's a challenge that we take on, and we're proud to manage. But it would be nice for it to be a little bit calmer.
That's good. Thanks, Andy. You mentioned before about being involved a lot with falls and frailty. It'd be very interesting to understand what that is and sort of what you're doing on that.
Yeah, so the ambulance sector naturally has evolved over a number of years, and reflecting really what our patients look like now compared to what they look like 20 or 30 years ago, the fact is patients or people are living longer. They're living longer independently alongside a range of other health conditions. So the sorts of patients we're now seeing, you know, through the 999 service are older. They are prone to frailty and those sorts of risks of deterioration, and of course they fall. So I became sort of interested through a number of routes, really. Latterly, the healthcare systems developing really good pathways of care that are accessible to all parts of the system. So the ambulance sector being one. So making sure that we flow patients into the right part of the system when they do have an episode of frailty or need further expert input. And on the fall side of things, really, that started, I don't know, probably 4 or 5 years ago, maybe longer now, because COVID kind of puts a pause on things and you lose track of time. But I investigated a case of a patient that we took a long time to get to. It's quite routine now, sadly, with the pressure we're under. Back in the day, it probably was 6, maybe more years ago, of a patient who fell in the night. We had a delayed response to them. They spent a long time on the floor. And when we investigated it, we realised that the initial fall itself was non-injury. There was actually nothing wrong with the patient when they fell, but the length of time they spent on the floor created all sorts of problems for them. It created several separate spells in hospital for specialist care. It led to them becoming less independent, more socially isolated, they deconditioned, you know, a lot of these things, and it was a real eye-opener. And so from there, I thought, well, you know, we've got to do something differently. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of what we talk about today will sort of cycle back to that first experience, really, of seeing falls differently from a 999 perspective, and how we respond to patients who often don't triage with a high priority, like because of the nature of what's wrong. If they're not injured, you know, the 999 system or the ambulance triage systems are really designed to find people who are in cardiac arrest. And then if you're not in cardiac arrest, have you got a serious immediate life threat? And of course, patients who fall often don't trigger those kinds of problems. So there's a risk of them spending longer waiting for a response, which is why, you know, I'm so excited about what we're doing to do things differently and be a bit more responsive and stop that patient being exposed to that risk, because that risk leads to some really significant consequence for them and their quality of life.
Absolutely. And you mentioned there about what that's then like for the patient. But as well as that, there's the pressure on the ambulance service and the system as a whole. And also there's the cost of that, isn't there, for all that extra care that could have been avoided?
Yeah, absolutely. And interestingly, you know, with things changing in terms of how services are commissioned and the ICS, ICB environment means that we are much more visible within the system. You know, we are a system partner. So we can bring our part of the story to the table, but we could also work collectively to make sure that, you know, the patient's pathway is as good as it can be, and that includes some of the preventative bit as well. Because you're right, the pressure that we perhaps see also can be amplified through the system. So a patient who is otherwise uninjured, who could be really well assessed and looked after in the community in their own home, who acquires, let's say, an acute kidney injury or a pressure injury or some other long lie problem, they go into hospital. Well, hospital has risks in itself. You know, patients can come to harm, they can catch infections, they can fall, they can decondition, and that's no fault of any healthcare professional who's working in a hospital, but there are just realities of hospital-based care. So we are positioning ourselves much more in a much more integrated way to try and help understand the risk and make sure that we respond differently in a much quicker, not necessarily quicker from a paramedic perspective, but as a system, that we mitigate those risks of a long lie and we offset those costs, because there is, as you touched on, there's a bottom line cost as well. Keeping someone in hospital is expensive. Community-based care can be more cost effective, but it always, for me, comes back to the patient experience. You know, patients do better in their own home for as long as possible.
Absolutely. Yeah, okay. What would be also interesting to understand from you is around falls, like what are the main causes, or what are the causes of a fall? And then like what are they a sign of? Like, falls can often be, can't they, a sign of something more?
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of cause, very wide range. And they're either caused by patient factors or sort of environmental factors. So things that you would sort of normally expect. So sort of trips, so tripping over the cat, slipping on rugs, worn out slippers, all those sorts of things. And then sort of patient factors can just be becoming frailer, becoming weaker, failing eyesight, you know, some of the sensory issues. And of course, those two factors can, or those two areas can intermix. So someone whose eyesight is failing may not see the trip hazard as well. So huge range of causes, which is, again, it's part of aging, and we've got to make sure people age well. You know, the benefits of modern healthcare, allowing people to live longer with lots of different comorbidities, the impact, you know, of that, for instance, you know, a patient who takes four or more medicines a day is at greater risk of having a fall. So there is a real sort of trade-off with keeping people independent, but treating the diseases and how those turn into risks and how, you know, they turn into falls. The important thing for us is recognizing the falls that happen and have no sinister cause. So you know, an acute medical problem versus those that might be caused by a problem with the heart. So, you know, heart being in the wrong rhythm and causing their blood pressure to fall, or other blood pressure problems, stroke or transient ischemic attack type problems. You know, there's lots of precursors, lots of warning signs. So we've got to be careful that we don't treat falls as a non-medical event if there is a risk of a medical cause, as opposed to someone who has just had an accident, as it can happen in any age. You know, children trip over things, adults trip over things, older people trip over things. So it's not a, my perspective or my perception is it's not a simple problem. And I think it's one of the most complex areas of care that we provide, because the stakes are quite high in terms of complexity and making sure we get it right.
Mm. Yeah, that's good. And you mentioned when we first spoke about sort of breaking the patient journey down in terms of how we respond, and then working out why they fell, and then referring them on. I'd be interested to learn a bit more about how you're doing that.
Yeah. So when we looked at a fall, and thinking back to what I was saying about how they triage, they triage often low priority, and that can lead to the onset of new diseases. So, you know, like a pressure injury and a range of other things, dehydration, hypothermia, and just loss of dignity, you know, not being able to get to the toilet in time and being incontinent. And what we realised was that there seemed to be a sort of a lack of will or lack of understanding about the risks of moving someone who's fallen. We can't respond quickly, you know, in the way we would like to. And what we were seeing, and it linked back to my investigation that I did previously, is that the advice is don't move them, give them nothing to eat or drink. You know, and these things are resolving now, and you know. At system level, you know, we're changing the advice we give to fallers, but that was from a public perspective, and also certain parts of society, some care homes are really unwilling to move patients because what if they've hurt themselves? So we looked at it sort of longitudinally and thought, well, actually, how can we do this differently? And also that other people have done this as well. So this is not a white heat of innovation just coming out of my organisation. There are similar models, but what we wanted to do is to not completely remove the need for a medical assessment. So we broke down the patient journey into three parts, really, which is the primary response, the rapid response that you need to get someone to the patient's side and to start mitigating the risk of that long lie. And that can be done by anyone who's suitably trained and is vetted to go into people's homes on our behalf. And I'm sure we'll talk about who does that for us later on in this session. But getting someone there quickly who can, and it's not just about lifting. You know, we were really keen to make sure that the people that were going to be responding on our behalf didn't see themselves as just a lift and shift service. It's a little bit more holistic than that. So we built the training around applying comfort measures, what we termed comfort measures, which is a patient on the floor, what are their basic human needs? So, you know, get down, speak to them, you know, reassure them, provide warmth, restore their dignity, all of those things that actually that's what you would expect. It's just good care, isn't it? And then expanding on to more sort of technical with a small t, I guess, which is having an awareness of the diseases that this patient's at risk at. So encouraging hydration, nutrition, particularly someone's been on the floor already for a long time, because we don't catch all the long lies. Asking about their medicines. Would they normally have taken their medicines by now? And then easing pressure areas, rolling them, keeping them warm, and then moving to a point where you can assess for suitability to lift. Or to get them off the floor, and we would rather coach people off the floor, and we assess them to do that themselves. So we teach some of the techniques to help and talk the patient through. And if they're unable to do that, then we'll use the correct device, lifting aid, and help them off the floor. And it was interesting when we were talking about this from a clinical governance perspective, and we almost brought ourselves back around to this conversation about, well, what if they're injured? Well, patients will tell you if they're injured. If you go to move someone and it hurts, or you can see that their leg is obviously deformed, then of course you're not going to get them up. The great thing about how we respond with our primary responders is that they give really good intelligence back to our control room and say, actually, this patient has got a fracture, or they have got a reduced level of consciousness, and they've got a head injury. Then we can respond more quickly. So that's the first bit. The middle bit, the sort of the secondary response, is really what we do anyway, which is sending a paramedic to make sure the patient's fall hasn't got a medical cause. And even, you know, a year after we put this together, we're now talking about the next stage, which is actually, do we need to respond ourselves? Because there's some really good responsive services in the community. So urgent community response might be a referral pathway we could take at source. And then the sort of what we class the tertiary response, the third bit, if we do, once we've been ourselves, is right, well, we don't want to stop the episode of care. This patient's had a fall for a reason. We need to then refer on to expert services. So it may be admission avoidance, it may be rapid response, it may be or urgent community response, or anyone else within the kind of fall sphere, the falls prevention team, making sure that the patient has a home care assessment, that they are able to do their normal activities normally, that they are still coping and can be as independent as possible. So we wanted to really draw out the patient journey and address the bit that needs addressing quickly and making sure they're moved on appropriately, as often as we can.
Very good. You mentioned in that response, Andy, about risk appetite. It'd be very interesting to get your thoughts on that, because I often find a lot of risk aversion when it comes to falls, like as you mentioned about people being worried about, are they injured? I'd be very interested to get your thoughts on like risk appetite at the moment and perhaps where we should be getting to with that.
Yeah, so there's a range of sort of stakeholders we have to consider. So I think we're doing a much better job within our organisation about risk appetite. So actually sending a primary responder, sending a volunteer or other agency that can get there quickly, and importantly allowing them to leave scene once their problem's been resolved. Because I didn't mention in the last answer, all of this stuff has clinical support available to it. So our responders can call into our urgent care hubs. So I think our risk appetite has moved. I think how we manage risk. We had a conversation a few months ago, and it sort of ended up with a realization that if you've got a broken wrist, is it not better to be in a comfortable chair with a broken wrist than laying on a hard floor with a broken wrist, mindful of all the other risks of coexisting fractures, and in the presence of a good, safe, or effective examination. But that was the sort of realization. I'm sure other people that respond to falls have had the same realization. So actually, it's still okay to move someone, with an injury. Some injuries clearly, are not compatible with moving patients. But even someone with a broken hip, thinking back to those comfort measures, you can still do things to mitigate their onward risk, just to keep them comfortable. And then there's other sectors we're looking at. So there's obviously the wider public, rather than being a sector, but the public in general, it's quite hard to get them thinking differently, and I'm not sure we'll ever fully achieve that. But again, that's where we need to move more quickly. And the kind of falls that we're talking about aren't the falls that happen in the street. So these are the falls that happen in homes. So there's probably something in the future around helping the families and carers of patients who are living independently to understand that if you call an ambulance in the future, if your relative or client falls, we might ask you to sit them up. We might ask you to help move them, or someone will arrive quickly and move them. But again, it's all about them understanding why we're doing that. Other sectors, so the care home sector is another sector we're working with a lot now. So we're doing a lot of work, and this is nationally as well, to help the care home sector understand risk in a very similar vein. And it's leaving someone on the floor for all the absolutely right reasons, and we understand what drives that response from residential settings. That risk of what if, but we're fairly clear and on what we're doing around that risk, and helping them to understand the risk and what it means from a safety perspective, a patient outcome perspective, and even a regulatory perspective. Because I think there's some anxiety about causing harm and what will that do for us as an organisation. So there's work ongoing there. People want to do the best for their clients, for their patients, so it's completely understandable. We've got to help transfer some of our medical knowledge, so to speak, and help them to improve how they approach their client base that falls as well. So again, this is the wonderful opportunity where sort of health and social care is so much more interlinked now, that we are all partners in the system, and there are many more avenues to have those conversations. So the future in that regard is really healthy.
Absolutely. And you mentioned about the risk of lifting someone when you shouldn't. I guess on the flip side of that is there's actually a number of risks with leaving someone on the floor when they don't need to be, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's incredible when you look at the list of conditions that you can acquire just if you're the wrong sort of body type. So if you haven't got much subcutaneous fat, not a problem I have. But even on a fairly warm day, you're the sort of the dynamics of how heat is lost, and on we're near Christmas and there's snow on the ground. So, and with cost of living, people not having the heating on, so you know the risks at this time of year are just, you know, amplified hugely. But yeah, the list of conditions that you can acquire relative to the risk of moving someone and causing them pain. And these are really difficult things to get square in your head. So someone whose wrist is deformed and it hurts, but have no other problems, thinking ahead to a little bit of discomfort or pain to get them off the floor to avoid, you know, having pressure ulcers, to avoid rhabdomyolysis, to avoid an acute kidney injury, to avoid, you know, the risks of, you know, secondary to or the load on the kidneys relative to becoming dehydrated. If you've got a long-term condition like diabetes, where insulin and food balance is important, you know, a long lie without being moved stops you then doing all the normal things you would do. So that's the landscape really that we have to look at in terms of risk of moving someone who has fallen. And it's a complex and quite nuanced area that we need to think about, and we've got to, you know, walk people or walk ourselves, you know, collectively as a system through that to make sure that we always just do the right thing, and remember, you know, how do I put this in a way that isn't misinterpreted, but you know, from an ethical perspective. And there's that, you know, you have to do no harm, but you also have to prevent harm occurring. So that, you know, the words sort of beneficence and non-maleficence, you know, in terms of medical legal or biomedical ethics, what we do now is beneficent. You know, we don't want to cause any more pain, any more harm. But from a non-maleficent perspective, if we don't move someone, there's a risk that we haven't prevented further harm occurring. So we're into sort of quite complex areas here of discussion, but that's the conversations we're going to have.
Absolutely, and it's not a quick process, is it? Changing Absolutely. Those perceptions.
Absolutely, it's not, and it's going to rely on us continuing to build and maintain relationships with all our system partners, because we're not going to cure falling unless someone turns off gravity. So we are going to have to, you know, embrace the fact that you know, our patient populations are getting older, they're living with, you know, many more conditions, and as a system we're living with those risks, and we have to make sure that we are cognizant of that and continue to work collectively to make sure patients get the best outcome. Yeah, and you know, it sounds like we're making a lot of the running. We're learning every day. So for every bit of engagement we make outwardly, we learn as much, if not more, from other partners in the system. So, you know, this is not an ambulance service or an ambulance sector or a paramedic thing. This is very much a multidisciplinary, multi-professional approach. So, you know, we've learned huge amounts just by being in the game, you know, in that setting.
Okay, that's good. Thanks, Andy. And we've talked about sort of the past and then sort of where we've got to now. I think that would be good to move forwards to sort of the future. And what are you working on in terms of new projects, new ideas sort of now and into the future?
So we're focusing really on just getting our model of care out there. So making sure that we've got primary falls responders in all of our operating areas, that we're making those partnerships and links both in the community and bridging into secondary care. So working with frailty teams and making sure we can access the same day emergency care pathways, and, you know, that we're making sure that patients that do need to come into hospital can avoid the emergency department wherever possible. So a lot of focus on same day emergency care, so SDEC as it's shortened too, helps us hugely because we can almost plan those journeys into hospital rather than the patient going to hospital at midnight. We can support them overnight, or the system can support them overnight if they're suitable, and then be taken into that clinic-based setting in the morning. So it helps us to schedule work and take some of the uncertainty out of our workload, which will help us, of course, respond more reliably to our high acuity patients, because they're still there. We still have our cardiac arrests and our childbirth and our strokes and our trauma that we need to attend as an ambulance trust. So it helps us hugely. So making sure that we continue on with that partnership approach, getting our model rolled out, and then looking at other sort of willing providers. And there's a huge will in other parts of the system to send people to falls. So there's lots of opportunity. And I personally think that falls aren't an ambulance service problem. I think it's a societal problem. So, you know, sharing some of that load and just embracing, you know, any willing provider, anyone who wants to get involved, would be great to look at those opportunities. There's lots and lots of agencies out there in the community routinely visiting older people's homes. I'm not suggesting that the post office should be responding to falls, but if you, as an example, if you look at the role you know, postal delivery, milk delivery has on monitoring patterns of behaviour, so milk left out on the doorstep, post not pulled in through the letterbox, you know, it's that big society role. So there's agencies out there that I think can help further into the future. I think the sky's the limit, but that's, yeah, probably much further into the future. The here and now is making that, getting us to a point where our model of care is fully rolled out and we've got responders ready to go across the whole region.
That's good. And what's your view in terms of getting volunteers involved in falls response?
So I think they're absolutely key. So we've had community responders, community first responders. Every ambulance trust has community first responders. That they are so dedicated, so skillful, so willing to learn, that they are such a strong resource. We've had them for years going to cardiac arrests. And so, you know, sending them to other types of patients, and they have been doing it anyway, but just doing it in a much more kind of systematised way, a more routine way, with specialised training, is just a natural progression. So yeah, the impact our volunteers have had, our community responders, already in the two areas that we've rolled out our falls model, the impact's been fantastic. So yeah, I think volunteers, and not for the sake of volunteering, I mean, we ought to sort of change the narrative a bit. These are people who want to contribute to their society. They're embedded within a population. They understand their local picture, so to speak. They're often connected into other parts of society, you know, be it sort of third sector or you know, other charities. So it's not just about recruiting people to do our work for us. That's not the point. It's about finding people that want to, as an extension of the traditional, so to speak, community responder role, going to sort of cardiac arrest, giving other people opportunities to contribute. Because some community responders who've been doing it for a long time don't actually want to go to cardiac arrest anymore, because there's quite a physicality element to it. So it offers more volunteers the opportunity to do things like attending fallers. Even if they're not doing the lifting, they can apply comfort measures. They can do that humanist care. They can get down with the patient, talk to them, hold their hand, put a blanket over them. So it's so valuable, and they're there in the community. So yeah, you can see I'm quite keen on them.
Absolutely, that's excellent. Now moving out a bit wider and looking a bit further into the future, where do you think the ambulance sector should be going in the next, say, 3 to 5 years?
Wow, big question. And I can only really answer that from my perspective, you know, outside the views of any individual organisation. I think the ambulance service has got, or the ambulance sector, you know, because the ambulance sector is worldwide. We are an intrinsic part of health and social care. You know, being mobile and responsive in the community with all the infrastructure that goes with that, you know, gives us a real unique position to work at a system level as part of a future offering. I think identity is really important. And I think we've absorbed things and adopted things by default along the way without ever really taking taking stock of what's changed and how we're responding differently. And falls are a great example. If you look at the, and this is absolutely no criticism, because it was designed to do a certain job, but our triage tools are designed to look for people who are very, very ill and working backwards from that. The falls and frailty type patient who categorises lower down the priority list. And this is not unique actually to falls. There are other patients who present in a certain way where at the time they have limited or very few, if any, priority symptoms, but are significant risk of deteriorating. That's just a symptom of how the ambulance sector has evolved and how patients are choosing to access unscheduled healthcare. So we've got to think, well, where are we in terms of what do we need to retain? Obviously, you know, the fire brigade are not going to sell any fire engines because there'll still be fires, but they may look different. You know, fighting a car fire, you know, now, you know, with fossil fuels versus, you know, what's the risk in 5 years or 10 years when everyone's got an electric vehicle? You know, how so they will evolve. We need to do the same. So we need to retain our core response to save lives. You know, get there quickly, resuscitate people, provide trauma care, stroke care, all those things, the high acuity stuff. What we can't do is do that at the expense of, if we retain the role of responding to fallers and low acuity or urgent care, we've got to somehow work out how to do that, you know, collectively. You know, how do we maintain the identity and role of a paramedic whilst balancing the importance of the patient accessing a multi-professional team for the right care with the right condition, or for the right condition at the right time. So, yeah, for me, I think the future is almost like a sort of ambulance 2.0. I think we've done ambulance version one. It's worked really, really well. And the ambulance service is saturated with highly skilled, highly motivated people who want to do a good job. I think the conditions have changed around us, which is impacting our ability to do that reliably. So I think 3 to 5 years is that check-in, you know, actually what conditions have changed around us to be in a position where we need to think differently whilst retaining our core purpose. Because I don't think there'd ever be any appetite among the public to change the ambulance service, in inverted commas, in the same way, you know, you can change things around the other emergency services, but fundamentally, you know, if something catches fire, you want to be able to call 999 and a red truck arrives. If someone's breaking into your house, a police car will arrive. You know, so that fundamental vision of there's an emergency, and that can be on a spectrum from, you know, someone has just collapsed in the supermarket and I don't think they're breathing, through to my frail aunt has fallen in the home and I can't get her up. For me, I don't see them as should be trading off against each other. The cardiac arrest needs an immediate skilled response. So does the fall. The fall is still a life-threatening emergency. It's just not immediately life-threatening. There's a progression of the risks that go with that. So, yeah, it's a tough one. So that's only my view. But yeah, the there has to be a future for the ambulance service, and I'm sure, because it's a fantastic, we said organisation, but it's more than an organisation. It's a bit of a way of life, really, and it will evolve and it will continue to improve. I think the current problems we're having, I hope, will pass as the wider health and social care system settles. But yeah, hopefully the future's bright with some little tweaks along the way.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think what you're saying about there being sort of two parts is the emergency response, but then there's the wider things in terms of the low acuity and actually more around prevention and speaking or seeing that person before it becomes a problem. Doing that will then reduce the pressure and actually enable the ambulance service to respond faster to those emergencies.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And being joined up, I mean, it's limited what we can do in terms of prevention, because often we don't find out about something until we get called for it. But shared care records, for instance, really good insight into that. We can both provide data and receive data on people. But there's certainly an efficiency discussion that needs to happen. So making sure that we're just a mobile healthcare provider. There is an emergency response piece and an emergency service piece, but we're a mobile healthcare provider, and we've got to make sure that we just understand who our different patient groups are, and how we service them appropriately. As I say, I think fundamentally, so one group aren't traded off against another.
Okay, that's good. That's been very interesting, Andy. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you. Well, that was interesting. There are a couple of key points that really stood out for me in that interview. I think, firstly, falls are not an ambulance service problem. They're a societal problem. So we actually need to look at how new and wider organisations can assist. Ambulance services need to maintain the core purpose of immediate emergency response, but actually new services should be engaged in responding to the less immediate instance, such as falls. And secondly, that was a real eye-opener on risk appetite. And he spoke about moving away from beneficence to non-maleficence. So actually moving away from what if we harm them by moving them to what harm will we do by not moving them. So that's episode 2 of Innovators in Care. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time for episode 3. Thank you and goodbye.